Hello and welcome to the Dance Futures podcast, the podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. I'm your host, Dr. Ruth Pethybridge, professional dance geek, and this is the November edition. And it's feeling very like November out there. The wind is howling, it's cold and dark, and it is the perfect time to get cozy and listen to podcasts, in my opinion. Yeah, funnily enough, the conversation begins with us both in bed. So fully channeling the hibernation vibes. My guest this month is Alexandrina Hemsley, who is an interdisciplinary artist working across dance and choreography, writing and film. Their most recent project, The Fountain, you might have come across it because it's been touring cinemas in the UK. It's an exploration of navigating Black lived experiences, memories, histories, and of course, futures. I'm really super excited that this episode is dropping just in time to also plug a free screening of this film on Wednesday, the 9th of November at 5 p.m. And I will put the link in the show notes so that you can access that. And I really recommend watching it. I would like to flag a trigger warning that Alexandrina very generously shares experiences of grief and loss, which centre around the stillbirth of her son. And so if that is something that is going to be upsetting in a way that you don't want to engage with, then I recommend stopping the podcast at around 30 minutes. For everyone else, really recommend listening all the way through. But I would say that, wouldn't I? However, it is a long episode, but that's the beauty of podcasts. Put it on, have a little nap, rewind, start again, finish it the next day, take it at your own pace. But yeah, I will be enjoying my geek out at the end, let's say, so I hope you will be there to enjoy it with me. And of course, regular contributor Luca Vaccari, who this month is beaming live and direct from a props cupboard in Frankfurt. And you wouldn't want to miss that now, would you? Alexandrina, do you use all your full name? Do you?
Yeah.
Alexandrina.
All 11 letters.
Yeah, I was thinking, how many syllables is that as well? I was like, I was going to say, do you use all your syllables?
I know.
I have a very short name, so one syllable wonder.
Punchy.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for joining us, or me, I should say, the Royal We, on the Dance Futures podcast.
You're very welcome.
And I like the fact that we're looking at each other on Zoom, and I can see kind of the beds reds behind us. So
yeah,
we're both recording from our bedrooms, and we were just chatting, weren't we, a bit about the pandemic, about the inception of this podcast. And I think it gave permission for this kind of working as well, where we're working to where we're at now and finding spaces in our homes from where we reach out to the world. So just sort of honoring that a little bit.
Yeah, and I think what we were talking about before, a bit like how to respond to the relentlessness of things, and then when you're speaking through the podcast as a way of nourishing, it's like if we remember that yes, there's the capitalism, and yes, there's all the bits that I certainly picked up from my education and my dance education and the kind of pace of that as well. And then it's like, oh, but there's also ways of tapping into these other cycles, right? Like these things, you're like, oh, work can also fuel me.
Yes.
Or like, you know, like how does that sit up against wanting to like undo lots of our I don't know, from the end really, like internalized working patterns, and something about working from bed. And I've had to do that before the pandemic with various like disabilities and health flare-ups, and how that sometimes feels like a contradiction, but sometimes feels like a possibility, isn't it? Because it's like bed is rest. And also, like, I do need to, or want to, still, like, connect. And
yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, because sometimes
part of
I don't,
don't want it to come into this space. Like, this needs to just be a separate space. It's my bed, it's where I, but also sometimes it's like, this is, yeah, making it, this is making it feel possible. And so that's how we're going to roll.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe it's that thing, isn't it? Like, I've got a cat at the bottom of my feet and I'm like, what can I learn about, like, the bedness or, like, the catness that nice. Will, like, soften how I then enter into work? Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, nice. Be more cat.
Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah, like I say, I already feel like we've touched on so many interesting and exciting things. And I've really loved reading a bit of your work on the web, on your website, on the World Wide Web. I sounded like a person then. I think, yeah, one of the things for me that I was excited by as well was the way that writing is very much part of your practice now, etc. But I wondered, for the purpose of the podcast also, like, how do you talk about your practice? Like, how do you describe it in a kind of almost a dinner party? Like, what do you say to people who maybe aren't as literate, if you like, in the field of this kind of interdisciplinary world? How would you describe it?
I like love and loathe the question, because I at dinner parties or like any event, I just freeze. Like, I don't actually know or always know how to talk about my practice, yeah, without getting too like opening the doorway to all the complexities involved in like being in a body and dancing and having that taken like seriously as a kind of inquiry.
Yeah,
I was thinking this through and I thought, you know what, I just start with the body. I just start there. And like, for me, the body is this container for all of this multi-layered expression and potential, and somehow dance is then this way of like surfacing the inner world.
Lovely.
Yeah, and I think I use improvisation specifically because it gives me this like immediate and fulfilling tapping into our senses, like what I see, what I hear, what I touch, like these things that then feed my dancing. And I think writing is exactly the same. Like, writing's another way of surfacing. And then the collage that I do, I started collaging also around 2015, actually, because I graduated 2009, graduated from Love in 2009, and then explored more writing more formally in 2010 at the Place. I tried to blend my dance and creative writing. It was very frowned upon at that time. Thankfully, things have changed. But at the time, I was encountering some
that's really interesting.
Blocks
around. What was the resistance then, do you think?
The resistance was because I was looking into like intersubjectivity in the body and how dancing can do this like many self thing. And I wanted to open each chapter of my final thesis with creative writing, with poetry, as again another way of languaging that felt more aligned with how I improvise and with dancing. And yeah, there was like a lot of the boundaries were firm, do you know what I mean? And I guess I was trying to like always soften them or like bleed or blend the spaces together. And I guess that's also then why collars have actually come in later into my practice, and printing on fabric. I think there's this tactile sense as well, and again like the clashes of many worlds, I guess.
Yeah, nice. That's so interesting, the kind of that the resistance. I think sometimes in academic contexts, you know, because there's this kind of form to writing, isn't there? And then it kind of to, and I think also that something about dance being quite a marginalized topic within academia, it sometimes means that there's an overcompensation for that of kind of like, we have to be taken seriously. We can't kind of, we need to like hold on to the rigor or something. And so then that can, you know, I think it's a false economy, but I just sometimes that plays into that kind of schism, you know, which doesn't need to be there perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the privilege, you know, I was able to write within an academic register because of having academic privilege. And I was then trying to like do a bit of slippage around that, I guess, which is partly the knowledge and privilege of understanding how the academic forms like work.
Yeah.
And also being in a marginalized body that's trying to always find other languages and ways around and ways of articulating where, I don't fit in or I haven't been invited into those spaces. So that language doesn't always make sense to me. The bodies that I read about are not the body that I inhabit. So how can I re-language that? And so it's again interesting, like when there are these obstacles, what are the obstacles trying to say? It's really interesting to hear this, like, that there's a kind of protectionist, like, we've got to protect the genre because we've got to have credibility, that's got to be taken seriously in this context. But again, it's like, who are we trying to get us to take?
Exactly. Seriously? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, but there's something also in there as well that you said about sort of knowing the rules in order to be able to play with them. That is a kind of, that's a particular position as well, isn't it? But this bringing in all these voices and ways of, you articulated that really well, so I don't need to repeat it. Thank you. what you said about starting with the body, that thing of kind of going, let's start with the body, and I love that, because I think, again, for me, who's as someone who thinks and writes about dance quite a lot as well, I can sometimes get a bit too far away from that, and I'm like, okay, let's come back to the body. Where does it start? I guess I'm curious in that, because you had fairly sort of, I guess I'm going to do traditional in inverted commas in the sense of training at Laban, obviously within a contemporary context, but nonetheless a conservatoire, and with all the things that brings. And so this kind of idea of dance, you know, with a capital D. And I'm just curious about your journey into that. If there's is there a moment that you remember, like, this is going to be an important part of my life trajectory, or did it find you in a more sort of organic way, this dancing?
I feel like I would have always danced or always played or something, you know, like, as in with my imagination. Like, I was very like shy child, and I had like imaginary friends, and I make up all these stories, and I grew up for a while in Nairobi, and then we had this like very different sense of like horizon, very different sense of space and warmth. And so this is also very formative. And then like the move back to London was like, it was so harsh, and my skin was lighter, my hair had to be like scraped back into this like bun for school, and
oh my goodness,
it was just very like definitely a moment. I was like, oh, something shifted here. And I do wonder then, like, I became very, very shy, and I think throughout my like school education, had various like silencing experiences related to race and mental health. But then within that too, I had a particular dance teacher who, like, I don't know, she gave me this like massive part in the school play. I think I had to stand in for like a sixth former, and I was in like year seven, I was like 13, I was like, what, how has this happened? But somehow that gave me this like gateway into going, oh my god, I can feel louder, or at least be like in my own skin, and at least feel myself fill up rather than continually need to like withdraw. And again, maybe what we were speaking about a bit earlier as well before we started, of like ways of extending outwards. Like somehow I had, through dancing at that age, like 13 onwards, I would say, dancing gave me this knowledge that I had, this presence that I could, you know, extend outwards as a way of connecting. As a shy person connecting, dancing became that for me, I think. So maybe that's why it then became essential. And then of course, like entering the industry or entering the conservatoire environment and then entering the industry had its own like things that I learned. Hugely grateful for the articulacy it gave me in body and words and sensation and tapping in, and then also all this baggage around like yeah, again, like not fitting in, not speaking the right things, not dancing the right things, you know, just a lot of that. And I think dance is still really central to my practice, even though, yeah, there's now a lot of more like interdisciplinary, you know, writing, film and collage and things that come through it. I guess it's just being shy. It's almost like innately bodily, isn't it? Because you're sort of in, and you're in your body. And I guess it's the body again being this like container that collects all these experiences.
Yeah.
And dance, it like gives the permission to transform those, or like at least move them around, so don't get stuck. Don't get stuck inside.
Yeah. It's so interesting hearing you talk. I sort of, because sometimes I realize I haven't asked myself the questions that I'm asking my guests. So I was kind of going, having never really been a shy person, but been somebody who's struggled with lots of, you know, body and confidence issues, and thinking about, the way that dance then provided an experience of my body that I could feel good about. Right. So there's this kind of, still this kind of thing where it allows us, a way of experiencing ourselves differently, perhaps, which is what you said about your teacher too. And I it also makes me really think, those positions that people in power hold, even if it's, you know, the teacher with the school kids, actually the level of sort of influence and holding that can happen in these small moments, or things like giving you that role.
The level of,
I mean, I'm sure you'd have found your way anyway, but into it.
The level of being seen, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Being seen. And I really resonate with what you said around, like, dance gives you an experience in a body that's, somehow for me certainly feels less tethered to my, like, less tethered and also completely tethered at the same time, experience of the mental health. It's like, I don't need to maybe it's about control. Like I can't control how my body is always going to appear, or my level of confidence in it. Dance like challenges that, as well as provides possibility around it being different, It's why I get really drawn, actually, to improvisation and to durational work, because I think there's something that happens, like, after you've been dancing for an hour or two, and even if that's, like, I mean, now it's not as if I'm, like, completely going super fast all the time with all the high legs. It's more like, let's just sigh. Let's sigh into dancing.
I feel you,
meander around. I just love getting to the point where my body surprises me with what it knows, and my body can catch me in a movement, and then I'm following my body, if that makes sense, or there's some other like synergy happening, right? I guess it's like going with the flow.
Nice. Yeah. I love that idea of surprise. Yeah. And it reminds me of a book, actually, which is called Taken by Surprise, which is it's a sort of a whole book with different contributions around improvisation. So I think that, that's really lovely, isn't it? And I think in this, as we've already, hashtag capitalism, already mentioned the big C word, but that in this society and structures that can feel very sort of, preordained, or that we have to follow certain things to have these moments where we can surprise ourselves and keep learning differently is super, super important. I love that. I love the way you articulated that. So this feels like almost a bit of a, like, I'm like, oh, I kind of feel like I could go down a sort of esoteric hole with you, but I'm going to kind of try and pull myself out and look at a little bit of your work, because I think the first time I came across your work was quite a while ago, actually. I haven't got the date, but Dad Dancing.
2012.
And I was doing a PhD at this time in cross-generational dance practice. So for a variety of strange reasons, that was where my focus ended up being my PhD. And So I mentioned dad dancing in my PhD as an example of intergenerational work that was happening. And I suppose part of the reason that that was my subject area is because I'm really interested in and fascinated by and supportive of the premise of trying to get more people to move their bodies in ways that feel good more often, and people who don't consider themselves as dancers to, you know, I guess get to experience a little bit of what we've been talking about. And I just think that can only be a good thing for the world, kind of thing. That's my sort of, that when I'm feeling idealistic and positive, that's my kind of way. But I wondered if you could share a little bit more about your, about that project, about your impetus for it, I guess. So where was that coming from for you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's so nice to hear that dad dancing like was part of something for you as well, and like resonated with your backstory. I think my first job actually was with Rosemary Lee, who I think you've also, right?
I've worked with.
So I was like an apprentice for Common Dance in 2009 and 10, that would have been.
Yeah.
And Rosie Hefford was there too, and Rosie Hefford and I studied at Laban, and then so did Helena Webb, and the three of us made dad dancing. I think, and they're all now up to like really beautiful things as well, Rosie and Helena. And we just learned so much during that project. I think first we wanted our dads to understand what we had chosen to do as careers a bit better.
Beautiful,
so we kind
yeah.
of started quite sort of simply, but also that's quite deep. Like,
yeah.
You know, these like primary male figures to sort of learn and encounter different ways of expressing things. And I think certainly for me, there was something around validation, and you know, I'm sure I can give myself a feminist reading around that, like why I would need this validation. But at that time, I did. And Rosie, Helena, and I were like, we're quite different makers. We have different focuses, but I think, like you, we're connected to this idea that we just love like the way people move. Like just the thing, the stories that can go, and the things that come up when people just really go for it. You know, like they just move because they want to, and like shed some of the shame around moving and around dancing.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then again, like yeah, that definitely that layer of like just challenging some of the biases and hierarchies around like who dance presentation, especially like who dance spectacle is for, and who's allowed to be on stage. And
yeah,
so yeah, the process was amazing. It was hard. But it was very beautiful. We learned a lot. We had great support, particularly from Southeast Dance and Battersea Arts Centre, and the way that they like co-held and co-produced that work, and the level, I think, of like integrity that we had around like workshops with loads of different family arrangements and different parent child parents, and also solo parents or solo children. And yeah, it was really beautiful undertaking. And I think, yeah, again, the intergenerational aspect was so important, and the next film work I'm thinking of doing is gonna draw on that experience again, I think. Like just
oh nice.
Yeah, I really want to work with an intergenerational cast again.
It'll come back in.
I think it'll come back in, and definitely some of the ways that we modelled bringing a cast who would fully participate in the work, like that didn't feel like a kind of token, now's the people who aren't professionals bit, you know.
Yeah.
The ways we were trying to do that in 2012, they have really informed how I like deliver workshops, and there's just been a lot of like things around the work itself that continue to.
Yeah, nice. I feel like there's a bit more recognition now, I guess, of how some of the cultures of care that exist in more sort of, I'm going to again use inverted commas, community context or context with, again, inverted commas, non-professionals, that there's some ways that we think about working that actually can go bottom up, you know, to the more sort of the more theatrical context or professional context for dance, that maybe that, yeah, I think there's more and more work around that happening, and more recognition of what's needed pastorally, etc. But it does feel like sometimes in educational contexts and these contexts that are working with a variety of people, there are different ways of looking out for the experience of those people that are really useful.
Yeah, that's true. And again, thinking about access, I know, how do people get there, and like, how do people access the offering, right, as well?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you're right, it's the opposite of like an elitist, only a certain number of people get to partake in this activity.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of like the audition models like that thrives on that, right? So, yeah.
Can I
and
ask
again, I guess that you have to live. Sorry,
I just wanted to know about your dad's whether your dad's like whether he's still dancing or whether that affected
you. So my dad is 82 now.
Oh wow!
He was like the oldest dad doing it, and he's still. I don't know if he's still dancing, but he does still really think of that project really like fondly.
Yeah,
and I have noticed that he has more confidence at like family get-togethers and things. Like he will get up and dance.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted what your train of thought was.
No, I was just thinking as you were speaking that like if we're trying to put those principles in place in our workshops or practice, it's also like a challenge to certainly to my own like internalized judgments and assumptions, right? It's like, if I'm encouraging the people in the room to like dance like, you know, like we don't care or whatever, it's like, oh, then I have to also
do that too.
Dismantle that, or I have to also show up in this democratic way even while holding the position of like facilitator or whatever. So
yeah, and it's holding the complexity of that, I think, because I also feel like I don't want to dismiss or disregard a dancer's training and knowledge, right? Like that is
absolutely
really valuable, and that's where if it gets too polarized, it becomes problematic. There are meeting places, I guess, between those two things, aren't there? And it's kind of finding the conflicts that can lead to kind of a richer understanding of each other and sharing in those things. Yeah, without feeling like we all have to let go of everything that we've learned or whatever, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, definitely. Yeah. And like that, I guess it makes me think of holding knowledge as equally, right? Like holding different knowledge.
Yes. Yeah. So again, I'm probably jumping around in terms of your career trajectory, so forgive me. But the next
it's pretty nice to hear I have a career.
Love that. Yeah, it doesn't always feel that way, does it, when you're sort of jumping from thing to thing and sort of
or just being so responsive, isn't it, so reactive.
I really remember that about being self-employed, that another thing I've used in my teaching actually is your project Black Hole, which was a collaboration with Seke Chimwenge. I'm going to not say it very well, I'm so sorry.
Seke Chimwenge.
That's the one. It was a collaboration with him. And I used it because I was taught wanting to introduce the idea of Afrofuturism to the students. And I think, as I said to you about this podcast, for me, there was something about just the ideology of sort of not always looking back, but kind of going, how can we imagine otherwise that Afrofuturism kind of brings into the discourse? And obviously, I know that's very specifically around race, and it's very important that it is. Obviously, but that there's something about just that way of thinking that came up in my last interview as well, around this idea of queer utopias that we were discussing, which is another sort of idea about this future orientated focus that it never necessarily comes into being, but by imagining it, we kind of create space for other things to happen or something. I don't know. So I find that a really sort of energizing way of thinking sometimes, and so I really enjoyed engaging with that work a little bit, and I guess I wondered about if you could say anything more about how you work with ideas like Afrofuturism is quite a big idea to sort of take on in terms of a performance work, isn't it? So I suppose it's kind of asking how do you kind of work with ideas like that, and then also how your sort of values or identity, or how that kind of plays into your practice? Is it?
I don't know if Afrofuturism is always looking forward. I think it's also trying to prioritize time as non-linear.
Yes.
Or like, I definitely remember, like, as I was sort of thinking through it, just looking through how many, like, how much white-led sci-fi borrows or steals, whichever we want to go with, from, like, many different tribal writings or aesthetics, or, like, you know, these kind of, like, pre-colonial, like, societal, cultures or aesthetics. And so I think also, again, this thing of, maybe it's also around mental health, where like a different relationship to time can happen depending on like when there's a crisis or not, or an overwhelm or not. And I think, but yeah, absolutely, with Afrofuturism, it has always been around imagining otherwise. And again, like a marginalized body, you know, like a body who isn't believed, or a body who some would prefer didn't exist, or like a difficult body or a disturbing body, you know, it's also like, of course, I've wanted to escape that narrative, but also escape it constructively rather than like completely disappear, right?
Yeah.
Those are the options. I either like make this into something, or I vanish. And I'd rather not vanish. So I'm going to try and find a way of making something constructive and building something else. And yeah, like this happening on like the page or stage or film and screen as a way of like exhibiting this agency, I think, and a place. And also a place to be multiple. And that's also what, when I read about Afrofuturism in 2015, because I was doing a photography series with Katarzyna Perlak, and yeah, it really felt like, you know when you have a book and you haven't read it for years, and then you pick it up off your shelf or something, and you're like, oh, this is the right time now. Or like, oh, loads of people have been like languaging this thing and such. Like, just like, yeah, this feeling I've had, or this sense I've had, it was just so much more like experience and articulation. So yeah, it really felt like a kind of meeting point for myself. And again, like a way of resisting white supremacy, but on our own terms. And I like this sense that you were saying around queer utopias, where it's not about the thing actually happening, but it is still about making making something real. Or something falling into place. And again, that permission. I mean, and it's interesting, like, trying to get that project funded, we had to explain what Afrofuturism was. And that was, like, that kind of would be unheard of now. Like, I think most mainstream institutions would now know what Afrofuturism is. They would have this kind of shorthand for it. But yeah, absolutely, 2015.
When was that, 2015? Yeah, that's really
interesting. 2016, we had to... I had to explain what Afrofuturism was, and then of course I feel like I have to explain and justify my practice and why this is of interest. So I guess there's always that kind of, still a bit of that baggage, I guess, somehow, around. But that's also, I take responsibility for that, because that is also where I've situated my practice. I have situated my practice in white-led and white-majority spaces, and
but have you had a choice about that? I hope some of those spaces exist, but they also don't exist yet. And so, of course, you're having to interact to a certain extent with what is in place.
But I feel like so many Black artists are doing that phenomenally. They're just, the way people are balancing that out, I get really inspired,
Do you have it, what... Oh, I'm just curious now, because you said that, like, are there, when you say branching out from that, have you found, are there networks that you're working with? You're saying there's artists that are inspired, but are there networks you're working with, things that we can name here on the podcast? It might be useful to name as well, that are not those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, with Fountain, actually, we're working with Dark Matter, whose like mission is to champion Black-led work more widely, and we're working with Kalma Arts, and Black Minds Matter. Actually, hopefully, we're just seeing if we can secure a partnership for the film to be screened, like, in partnership with them. And then I've just been given Black Business Incubator, which is at Somerset House, which is kind of like an arm of Somerset House. So I'm hoping that that will, increase some networks.
Yeah, and that's, it's great that you mentioned Fountain there, because that's sort of jumping into now, yeah. Which, I was so excited to see, just a dance geek perspective. I was like, oh my God, there's like an abstract dance film doing a tour of the Phoenix Cinemas. I was just like, this is, yeah, this that's really seminal. Like, congratulations. I'm so happy that people are seeing it and it's doing that. It's great, you know, paving the way. Can you tell? Yeah, like, I guess, be really interesting to know more about that project in terms of where it sprang from and how that kind of happened.
Yeah, of course. Like, yeah, thank you. I also share like this kind of like, whoa, non-narrative based, like improvised contemporary dance is doing this tour. It does feel really special. That is in no small part to, yeah, again, Dark Matter and their like fearsome championing of the work. I feel really lucky to have that support in place. So Fountain. It's like the latest in a long line of things where I've been exploring these like watery metaphors, or particularly my writing, where water can be this metaphor for being held, like in a bath or swimming, or somehow a comfort, and then also be this element that can entirely overwhelm. And I've been using that as a way to think through moments where, yeah, I've been like emotionally very flooded, or there's been lots of uncertainty, or you just have to kind of, shift through the tides. And then of course, like, you know, all the water in our bodies, like there are so many resonances, and there's lots of writing that like hydrofeminists have done, and
hydrofeminists. Oh my God. Hydrofeminists. Love that you just brought that in.
Like, how is this?
Google that one.
Yeah, incredible.
Wow.
And just that thing of also like the forgetting of waters, you know, like does patriarchy forget that we all came from like a very watery vessel of the womb, and like, so,
and there's that the ascent of woman, I'm not good. It's not going to be a good anecdote because I can't remember properly, but there's the ascent of man, or the descent of, I can't remember, but there's the theory that actually, rather than the apes, you know, that actually the kind of female and the fishes and the underwater, and oh, it's terrible because I can't remember it properly, but I just got overexcited then when you were talking and thought, oh wow, yes, I remember hearing about this as a kind of antithesis to the stories that we're always told. That's all the land based,
right? Like a beautiful, yeah. Oh, nice, like a beautiful kind of speculative slash. Going to be definitely true. Ecological.
Carry on my little tangent.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it was going to be a live work initially, just a way of like bringing dance more with more certainty or more clarity or something, more cohesion into these ideas that I've been exploring in my writing. And then the pandemic hit, and then I had to shift it, thinking it through to a film. I've worked with film again since 2015. I've made several ones, but this felt like important and ambitious to kind of not just do by myself. Like not kind of, yeah, just kind of bring a team together. So I did apply for a digital commission from the Lowry, and so they're supporting the work. And then the editors, Kat, I've worked before with, and then I've explored building these like digital landscapes. So Fountain basically blends this like live dance, it's set in a black box theatre, and it blends it with these digitally constructed watery environments and watery embodiments. And I worked with a director called Jack Baraclough on those aspects, and I've worked with him before on Black Holes, and also Jamila Johnson Small and I have worked as Project O with Jack on some of the voodoo imagery, and a film called Saved. So yeah, I think the digital landscapes, again, are this way of like speculating and extending our imaginations and yeah, making real these environments, like environments that can hold a body, like when you feel prickly, how to make a prickly environment, or like I think just again, like to give a visual indicator of some of these. Another word I came across, I love it, psychogeographies, like
yes,
these kind
yeah,
of things
yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
are, you know, they're within us and they're also outside
of us. Yeah, absolutely.
How we can relate. There is also like, you know, grief and loss within the film. Intrinsically, that's linked to histories of colonialism and water within African and Caribbean peoples and those of us within the diaspora. What I was particularly struck when I was thinking about water was the way that it's not only land that was carved up, it was also these watery pathways, like these rivers. And then I just thought, God, how that adds this whole other dimension to, again, what control or what submission or domination can feel like if you're trying to also stem the direction of water flow by putting like these boundaries within that, these like land borders within water. So there's that kind of wider fabric, and then a kind of personal loss happened. I partway through the process I experienced the stillbirth of my son, and so I had to like step back. So I was planning to be in the work pregnant and kind of access the tides of the water that way, but instead I was, you know, overcome with grief, and the shoot went ahead without me, and then we sort of postponed. The work was supposed to tour in April this year.
Wow, okay.
We postponed it to September. So yeah, there's
that,
like,
is such a journey, and then I must see for you, seeing it now without you in it, that must be, I mean, I can't even really find the words, but that must be huge.
Yeah, it is really affecting. I think again it's like a huge amount of gratitude for having set up a company in 2020, Yuanda 103, that gives me a format that things can carry, they can happen. Mm-hmm. They have to happen differently. But, you know, if I'd gone through that experience a few years ago, everything would have had to completely stop. And I had to let go of a lot, like professionally, and not being in the work when already I had to take a step back from performing due to other injuries and other caring responsibilities for the past few years. So it kind of felt again like, oh, I want to get back into performing. And then there's actually this massive event and massive loss. So yeah, there's huge gratitude that, again, my producer Nancy Mae Roberts has like pulled it out the back, and also the backing. And I guess this thing of like having a longer career has meant that I can also pull on those resources. And then at the same time, of course, watching the work and doing the edit was it was very, very challenging. And it can still be very moving watching the work. And at the same time, I'm very glad that it's out there.
Yeah, I bet. It's testament, isn't it, also to the thing of sort of the support that's needed to make work and to be an artist, isn't it? It's kind of like the which I think dance in general, there's a recognition of working with other people in collaboration is really central often, but sometimes there's still somehow this kind of this is quite solo kind of endeavor of making it all happen. So it's really great to hear that, you know, you've moved into that part of your career that where you can have these support networks around you, and that that it could carry on.
On, and the dance was just phenomenal. Like I'd worked with each of them before, so it also felt like they were able to do a lot of holding.
I was going to say, like, the nature, it's really interesting also how the nature of the work potentially what you were going through and experiencing, you know, a different project might have not been able to carry on, or sort of you might not have been able to engage in it in any shape or form. I can sort of imagine that but something about the relationship of that work to what you were going through in a way maybe also meant actually it can carry on
and go ahead. That's really true. I hadn't thought about it in that way, like maybe the principles that I've had to put in place and that still get really tested around, like a kind of disabled-led, access-led way of working where, yeah, the structures are porous enough that there can be absences, particularly mine, like that can still mean that work happens and that art making happens. But I also know that we are in this landscape, again, when you're mentioning capitalism, of like real impatience. Mm. And I don't know whether or not that, and that's something I definitely internalize as well. It's like, or there's a lot of shame then when you have to go to a venue and go, I'm really sorry, I can't do this now.
Yeah.
It still carries a lot of that. And I think that, you know, we're having to be so careful about how we language the pandemic and how we're still in it. And this real like drop in patience, like colleagues and peers who are shielding, they just keep telling me there's such a drop in patience now for meeting people, like you were saying, like meeting what care needs to be in place for people to still participate in work and in their working lives. And that's totally not sector specific at all.
No.
That's huge, isn't it? That's national. But yeah, there's a lot. It's like this access-led model that I really try to do, and in some ways I'm better at advocating it for other people, like with a bit of distance. It is by no means like perfect, and we still get into these moments where everyone's working past their boundaries, and and that has definitely happened in like the delivery of the fountain tour as well. It's like, oh my god, we're doing this massive thing, how are we doing this massive thing?
Yeah, and it comes up time and time again, that thing of when you're working with something that's very close to your heart, then yeah, it becomes that you're willing to do that, but also that then that gets exploited, and that's, you know, that's run through so many of the conversations on this podcast, is that kind of tension between those things.
And it's interesting, isn't it, like how much the industry still relies on unpaid labor.
It just
does, like you say, whether or not there's like a kind of a willingness and like a self sort of complicity in it, or actually there's also just like the demand for it and the lack of recognition that not everyone can show up in those ways that carry a lot of privilege to do. What you're saying made me think of something else, and I can't remember. Maybe it'll come back to me.
Yeah, because you've touched on mental health occasionally through the discussion, and that thing of sort of showing up differently, or how we create structures and spaces. And I guess in a way it links to my next and final question, which is around kind of what we might want to see in the future for the dance sector or kind of industry. But I'm really conscious in certainly in teaching that we're grappling such a lot with the kind of, you know, the other pandemic of the mental health issues that a lot of young people are facing and dealing with day to day, and then at the same time trying to deliver something that has set standards because that's what people are sort of working towards or whatever. And you know, it's such a difficult thing in a system that isn't designed sort of for humans in a way.
or designed for like one human. It's like they look designed it for one human. one person just gliding through life.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the rest of us are like, ow, ow, ow.
Yeah, exactly. Who is that person?
Who is that person? Where are they? And they need to write all our funding applications, you know, like for the sector. There's one person who has a breezy life. They can use all that excess energy they can just put towards helping everyone else. I think it just still comes back to inclusion, and it's such a loaded word. I still feel like I need to understand what this word can even mean or what it can look like, and especially like it can get so easily reduced down with like diversity and equality and but I think honestly it just has to be sustainable working conditions so that we have the energy to lobby and policy set around working conditions. Like I feel like dance, like you were saying, dance is marginalised within academia. I feel like dance is also really fringe still within the wider like cultural sector and wider union bodies. And I know Equity are doing some like phenomenal things, and there is more sense of that, but it's compared to visual art, theatre and music, there's still this hierarchy, and it still feels like we don't even have the data. We're not even collecting the data on impact of on dancers. Maybe we are, and I don't know, but it just feels like I've been part of several conversations because I'm a steering group member of a cultural advocacy group called What Next? And dance isn't as represented as I would like it to be. And I do think it's because our bodies are just so primarily implicated in all the things that are tough. And like you say, all the things that can individualize, like maybe there'll be people who can talk way more eloquently and with more expertise around what it is to collectivize, but it's like how to do that when I really feel like we are also exhausted. And there's like loneliness, and like you say, mental health and in young adults, it's like, and those that you're teaching, it's got such a huge impact. And how can a dance education environment that like also needs you to be pushing your body, it does need that.
Yeah,
it's just that we need to also untangle that everyone's body will be pushed or trained. It needs to be like from what they can do. What can support everybody. But that kind of, you know, there is a physical requirement to dancing.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
How to hold on to that without excluding and by welcoming, like, I mean, you know, and how do we audition but hold compassionate values? Or how do we...
Yes.
You know, like, how?
Yeah, I
generally don't audition, but that doesn't mean that... that doesn't mean that I shun those that do, but I have a question of, like, how do you audition and sustain principles that are going to be better for a dancer's future? Like, are gonna do the...
Mm.
Do the work of like what needs to be undone in those spaces as well.
Yeah. And in terms of your dancing future, you said you wanted to get back into performing. Is that still, are you still wanting to do that? And where does that sort of motivation come from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because it wasn't a choice to stop. I had an injury
in
2019, and I had to, and also mental health things. Although I still was dancing with a lot of my mental health stuff. The physical injury kind of stopped me in my tracks. And then I have been performing in Jamila's work at Somerset House this autumn. We can no longer deny ourselves. That's on until the 30th of October. I don't know if the podcast will be going out before then. But so I have been performing, and Jamila works under Seraphine 1369 as their artist name. And that felt really good. And it felt nice to be like, oh, there is still knowledge in this body, right? There's still things that I want to say and things that can only happen in a live moment.
Yeah.
So I guess that's where the motivation comes from. Like, liveness is still very important to me. And it also is something that I still bring into wanting to make the films I make now as immersive as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's been something that's been so nice about the Picture House tour, because like the scale, like the volume of space means that these dancers are like, oh, they're just magnificent. They're like, I don't know, it's just so lots of close-up footage, and that again just drawing audiences into the detail of dancing still feels really important. And so I guess maybe live performance for me will always be where I can access again some of that detail, the detail of like being witnessed by an audience as well. So watch this space. Next year there'll be some.
We will be watching this space, Alexandrina. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and hear about your work. And as I said, unfortunately Fountain has not made it as far as Cornwall, but I do hope there'll be somehow in the future an opportunity to see the full length version.
Thank you for reminding me. We're doing an online screening on the 9th of November.
Okay,
the
amazing.
9th of November at 5 p.m. and it'll be free. So I don't know, with the podcast, maybe we can link to it.
Yes, I will. I'll pop up some links on our social media page, which is Dance Speakers. podcast on Instagram. We will do that, and I'm definitely going to try and see that. How exciting. All right, well, thank you so much for your time, Alexandrina.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thank rich you. And yeah, such a pleasure. Yeah.
So lovely to chat. Thanks for so many lovely questions.
Luca, hello.
Hi, Ruth. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. Bit tired and kind of November-y over here. I don't know what it's like in Frankfurt.
It's cooling off.
Yeah.
The leaves are falling and it's getting chilly.
And I love that I'm speaking to you in like a props cupboard.
Yeah, I'm in the costume cupboard. It's actually the warmest building, warmest room in the building. There's also a boiler in here. So I'm sweating.
So there's a boiler and there's designer leopard print jackets that you can wear. Perfect. So, what did you think of Alexandrina's interview? What struck you?
Oh, it was a really great interview, and it was so exciting to listen to another dance artist who works from a very researched-based practice.
Yeah.
And the reading and the writing that she does to inform her physical practice, I thought, was something that I could really relate to.
Yeah.
It was great to hear her perspective of how she incorporates this dichotomy between language and physicality.
Yeah, totally. I agree. I really enjoyed that as a kind of in the dance geek zone of kind of going, oh yeah, these things that exist in very separate realms, but also can really inform each other. Yeah, I agree.
And I think we've spoken about it before on previous episodes, but that dinner party scenario, trying to introduce yourself and what you do, it's so painful. And I really relate to that experience as well.
Yeah.
I get really frustrated with myself because you really feel like you've just spent 5 minutes trying to justify what you've invested your time and money into.
Mm.
And if I had gone and done a law degree, I don't think I would ever have to try and justify to someone why I went and did that. And So dance feels like a double-edged sword because you're never the boring one at the party, but it leads to more questions and expectations, you know.
I think you're really right.
Splits halfway through the evening and like,
oh god, yeah, we're back there, aren't we? Always the splits, all like, oh go on, you know, teach me. I was stopped in the street by someone working for a charity in London, and as soon as we engaged a little bit in conversation, it was straight into, go on, teach me something, teach me some moves. And you know, you're like, it's well-meaning, but yeah, I thought Alexandrina dealt with that question really beautifully, and this kind of thing of starting with the body and coming back to that as the starting point for everything. I found that a really useful reminder somehow.
Definitely. And using dance with a capital D and making space for dance in our education and well-being systems and just life in general, and pushing it to the forefront and getting the word out there that dance is a really useful tool to kind of make ourselves happier and healthier humans, whether you want to go and pursue a career in it or whether it's something that you do just to support your everyday life. I think it's so important
an advocacy issue there, isn't there, somehow, for the discipline, which is something that I deal with in other kind of job roles, is this thing of how do we shout louder about what is already happening and advocate for this practice. And I think Alexandrina actually refers to something called embodied advocacy, which is more, you know, engaged with social justice themes, but from, you know, from the body. And I think, yeah, as you say, we need to get the word out. We're shouting about it on here as much as we can, but I just, come on, listeners, I don't know how many people are listening to be able to spread that word, but yeah, I agree.
I was also wanted to pick up, I think you were hinting towards it in the conversation, but maybe there wasn't time to go into great depth about it. But now that I'm in a teaching role myself, how do I teach and educate with trauma-informed practice and educating ethically? And we can talk all day long about sort of the ideal scenario, our queer utopias or our Afrofuturist worlds. But right now, some of those things just aren't possible because of the societies that we live in. And something that I'm thinking about every day is, how do I make my dance classes safe and accessible and non-triggering for my students? But also, the harsh reality of the world is that there are difficult things to talk about. And I think it's maybe counterproductive to skirt around certain subjects. And as long as there's a good, healthy, safe conversation about them, I don't think it's about stopping those conversations at all. And I think dance is a really great place to be able to safely and nurturingly bring those topics into the light.
Yeah, I mean, as your former teacher, it's so beautiful to hear you reflecting on your own role as a teacher. And you know, I think you're right. I think there is, I'm writing a paper at the moment about trauma-informed practice, working with a psychologist, because there's loads and loads of information in psychology about trauma-informed work. And in dance, I think a lot of it has been quite either in the field of dance movement therapy, which is a different kind of realm, if you like, or quite kind of intuited. And I don't believe that that makes it less valid. I think a lot of the, you know, the sort of relational skills that we have as dancers, the empathy that we generate through working with other people, is a very real sort of soft skill, if that's how you want to call it. But there are also some really specific kind of ways of working and holding space for people who have experienced trauma that could usefully inform what we're already doing potentially. And I think as long as it's a two-way street and there isn't a hierarchy around that, in terms of, I think Alexandrina put it really beautifully when she said, you know, it's sort of holding these different knowledges in equal regard kind of thing. So I think there's something to be said for that, in terms of how we can usefully work across these disciplines and across sort of psychology and dance, for example, being one example. And unfortunately, as you say, right now there is a lot of trauma, you know, and there are a lot of people who've had these experiences that can be referred to as trauma. You know, even post-pandemic, young people particularly, I feel, have lived through something really, really extraordinary, and we need to not forget how disparate those experiences were during that time. So yeah, really good point. Yeah.
It's always complex and interesting when you're it feels like there are these two spheres within the dance world. There's a sphere that wants to use dance as a tool to therapize trauma and process these events in our lives, but then it would be naive not to acknowledge the fact that dance training in and of itself can cause trauma. Yeah. You know, the way dance has been taught traditionally, again, inverted commas, over the last 100 years, has caused trauma in our industry and in our community, in the dance community. And I think it's, how do we kind of reach out to help people with our dance skills, but also look inwards as a dance community and go, hey, we've got some work to do. There are some rotten apples in our barrel, and they need to be ousted.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really, really good point. And I think it's something that, was recognised both in this interview and in the last one with Cloud. And indeed, in general, that theme of sort of unlearning certain kind of scripts that we have from dance training in order to find what our practice is, again, both as dancers, as makers, and as teachers, is like a really key part of what Dance Futures requires, you know, if we're going to have a future with dance as a central part of it.
And maybe the last point to end on, because it was something that you both spoke about in the interview, was using dance as a way to find the positive aspects about our body. Despite dance training potentially being triggering and traumatic, also in the things that we've learned about dance, we learn things about ourselves and learning to love our bodies. And I was thinking that women and queer people and people of color especially are told that they're not allowed to love themselves. Yeah. But I think dance is a way that I've found a healthy way of loving myself, but avoiding that like vanity aspect.
Yeah.
And dance being a really healthy way to practice self-love.
Let's end on dancing towards self-love, everybody, acknowledging yay all the other aspects of it too. Thanks, Luca. Don't overheat in that cupboard. Get out of there.
Wow. Well, honestly, I'm not quite sure where to start because I could do a whole nother episode just geeking out on all the fascinating concepts that were raised in that interview. So I'm going to try and not do that and keep this succinct. But this is the part of the podcast where I get to indulge my deep geek-tastic enthusiasm for dance scholarship and also philosophy more widely. My plan was this series, because I'm highlighting some fantastic queer dance artists, was to keep dipping into the book Queer Dance, Meanings and Makings by Claire Croft that I mentioned in the last episode. But I have to confess that I have got very distracted by the concept of hydrofeminism. I mean, I'm sorry, it's just too good to not dig into that a little bit. So I did want to kick off by referencing the queer dance book, just because to raise this idea that Claire Croft notes in the introduction that queer protest was really closely aligned with civil rights movement and radical feminism, where women were using their bodies to make radical calls for change in hostile environments. And I think this really resonates with some of the ideas that are coming out of hydrofeminism. And also aligns both of those things, the radical feminism and queer theories and practices, together. So it's not so much a digression, hopefully, as a kind of parallel journey of thinking and doing. I also wanted to flag up that in my waffle, I mentioned a book called The Descent of Woman. It's by Elaine Morgan, and it's probably quite outdated now, but I couldn't bring the title to mind in the interview. But if you did want to check that out, that is what I was waffling on about, The Descent of Woman, Elaine Morgan. There's some, like I say, there's been lots more things published more recently about female sexuality in particular, but there is some, it's an interesting starting point and point in history. So, hydrofeminism though. When I started looking into it, there is a name that seems to be kind of synonymous with it, which is Astrida Nirmanis, a philosopher who's associated very strongly with hydrofeminism as a kind of concept and movement. And so I'm going to read you a little paragraph from their chapter, which is called Hydrofeminism or On Becoming a Body of Water. And it's from a book called Undutiful Daughters, New Directions in Feminist Thought. And it just made me really excited. Hopefully you'll be able to see why. So Nirmanis writes, even while in constant motion, water is also a planetary archive of meaning and matter. To drink a glass of water is to ingest the ghosts of bodies that haunt that water. When nature calls sometime later, we return to the cistern and the sea, not only our antidepressants, our chemical estrogens, or our more commonplace excretions, but also the meanings that permeate those materialities. Disposable culture, medicalized problem solving, ecological disconnect. Just as the deep oceans harbor particulate records of former geological eras, water retains our more anthropomorphic secrets, even when we would rather forget. Our distant and more immediate past are returned to us in both trickles and floods. And that same glass of water will facilitate our movement, growth, thinking, loving. As it works its way down the esophagus through blood, tissue, to index finger, clavicle, left plantar fascia, it ensures that our being is always a becoming, an alchemist at once profoundly wondrous and entirely banal. Water guides a body from young to old, from here to there, from potentiality to actuality. Translation, transformation, plurality proliferates. I mean, just getting to say plurality proliferates is pretty cool. I recommend you try it. Try it also after a drink. It's a good tongue twister. I find that a really beautiful concept. Hydrofeminism at its root is a theory of kind of radical collectivity, because it's talking about if we are all in this kind of fluid continuum, then what does that really mean for the boundaries of the individual self and ways of relating to one another? It also really resonates for me with dance studies in the way that a very ordinary or sort of everyday activity, such as doing a pee in this instance, a very physical and material experience, a very human experience, is also one of the ways that meaning is created in the world and isn't neutral, I guess. And obviously it has links with ecofeminism and the way that humans interact with the planet and the different elements that are that make up this planet, this beautiful planet. So in dance studies, there's often this capacity to kind of zoom in on the physicality of the body. And I really, really welcome that in any kind of philosophy, that it's grounded in the body. I mean, as Alexandrina said, as this episode is called, it starts with the body. So as you go and drink your glass of water today, maybe it'll just give you pause to reflect on your own capacity for fluidity.
Hello, lovely listeners. Luca here. Thank you so much for tuning in this month for our interview with Alexandrina. It is so exciting for us to be able to talk to such impassioned people and to discuss everything dance related. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with your friends, dancers or not. Although in our dance future, we hope that deep down everyone is a dancer. You can follow us on Instagram for the latest updates on our show, and we promise not to spam your feed with endless pictures. We don't have time for that. Okay, that's it for now. I'm getting out of this costume cupboard. Until next time, goodbye.